All right, you're on.
The meeting will be officially called to order. Can we have a motion to approve the minutes of February 28th?
So moved.
Second. Okay, is there any exception to those minutes? Saying none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
And I'm sorry, we should do an introduction.
I'm just here as a guest. I'm Caitlin Januszewski, the president of the Graduate Student Association.
Okay, great. All right, we'll go right into President Jones' report.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. I'm going to really, I say this every time, but I'm really going to try to keep my message very short. I felt dismal each time we meet, but we'll give it the best shot today. Because as we put the agenda together, we think it's important to make sure we have the time for the deep dive that we're going to be taking regarding a whole enrollment management strategy. And so that's where we want to spend our time to make sure each and every time we meet, we have a substantive issue for you to engage in. So I'm just going to give 30,000 foot view overviews of a few things. First thing I want to just emphasize is the new academic program development activity that we have been talking about. We are making significant progress in moving forward the development of these new academic programs that we do believe will be transformative, will be a game changer in terms of the ability of this university to attract a type of student that heretofore it hasn't been able to attract. It's going to help elevate the profile of our incoming students and help advance all of our agendas regarding recruiting more students that are from non-resident other parts of the U.S. as well as international. And the first one you know is the engineering degree program. It's worked its way through all the approval at SUNY System Administration. There's a team of folks out of the provost's office that involves faculty from computer and information sciences and other disciplines outside of our computer science school that are working on this as well. And they are looking at a strategy where we will be admitting the first 30 students as transfer students in the fall of 2015. And these will be transfer students from Hudson Valley, Schenectady, where we can find them that are in existing programs. And that is the most strategic way to start a new academic program, start out with upperclassmen. And then in 2016, we will start this fall thinking about recruiting the freshman class, because we'll start the freshman in 2016. So we're very, very excited about this. Each and every place we've had an opportunity to talk about this engineering effort is, people are raising some questions, and it's rightfully so on the academic side of the house. People are very excited about this development and see it as a game changer for you all, and we certainly believe it has the potential to do so. In addition to that, the other thing we talked about was big data analytics. And for the last 6 months, we've been planning a conference that was held this past Monday on big data. And I don't exactly know the number of people that were there, but we had standing room only in the D'Ambra auditorium over in the college, the life sciences building. And it was a very good discussion, because not only did we bring people from the university around the table, but it also brought scholars from other parts of the country, from University of Washington, from Stanford and other places that came around the table to provide expert testimony about big data and big data analytics and the role that it can and should play in the future of academic offerings at this university. We also were strategic enough to invite in a lot of key state of New York resources, like the Commissioner of Tax was there and a number of other people, and it was just tremendous to get those folks' input and to hear them say this is a valuable opportunity that they want to partner with you all on. So again, we think this is going to be another source of new academic energy. It's going to help transform this university. And I won't go into this a lot, but you'll be hearing a lot more about this. The biological sciences is the other area where we're working, as well as the trying to grow an increased number of program in the health sciences as well. And I think we're making a lot of progress there. So we'll wait to give you more update on that a little bit later. The CNSE SUNY IT merger, you all know that that's been announced, been vetted and approved by the Board of Trustees in terms of their merger with SUNY IT as a way of delivering the academic model going forward. We have been working diligently for almost the last 7 to 8 months now on an MOU. I think we're close. We have pretty much worked out what we think is a fair financial arrangement across food service, general ed requirement, housing, recreational, sports facility, healthcare, transportation, and parking. We pretty much...
Is that Rob? Rob?
Hey, guys. I'm sorry. I apologize for being tardy. I'm here.
All right. Welcome, Bob. How are you? Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah, just barely. It's a little dim. I'll turn my volume up.
We have been vetting this MOU. Provost Phillips has been one of the main drivers of this, along with our financial people. We have been going back and forth with CNSE, significant disagreement about what we should charge for the general ed requirement has been the biggest sticky point. And so we have reached a compromise position with the chancellor that I think she'll be presenting to CNSE as the bottom line deal. And we're comfortable with that compromise because it clearly will be fair to both CNSE. Most of all, it's going to be fair to the students. We have no markup in what we're trying to charge. And we were very insistent on that as a core principle going forward. So once the chancellor has a chance to respond to this, I think it's appropriate, Mr. Chair, we bring that back for vetting and approval by this body. We may have to do it as a conference call rather than waiting until we convene again, but I wanted to make sure that you had a chance to look at that agreement. And so that's moving forward, as well as, in addition, there's a whole laundry list of things outside of the things I just mentioned that also have to be vetted in terms of real estate, infrastructure that we share, and that some are on this side of the road, some are still, ours is on that side of the road. And so there's about a two-page document of other issues that we have to resolve. And the provost is working to identify folks on at least our side of the table that's going to be part of the vetting process for that. And we have signed off on deactivation of the programs that needed to be deactivated because we had to do that to allow CNSE to start recruiting for those programs starting next academic year. Farnina's not here, so I can give you a brief update on fundraising activities. Our total fundraising numbers are up 75% compared to last year. With $8.7 million raised to date. And so this year we are on track to surpass the $10 million target. And we're very, very pleased that $1.5 million pledge from the Standish family and the $2 million pledge from the ARCO group for the standards in arts that we announced a few months ago, but that's part of that fundraising goal. So we're very, very pleased with the progress that we're making there. The 2014 Citizen Laureate awardees have been named, and you know that's one of the major fundraising activities for the foundation. We are pleased to report that the academic laureate is Father Kevin Mullen from president of Siena College. The community laureates are Dan Nolan, I think you all know Dan, class of 74, and he's president and CEO of Hugh Johnson Advisors LLC. And then the community laureate is Phoebe Bender, who's a community volunteer. And the dinner will be held on the 6th of November 2014, so we expect to see you all there. It's a tremendous event. And I'm being told to remind you that cocktails began at 5:30 p.m. All right, the announcements about new staff. We have hired a new director of development for athletics. And we're in the process of hiring a new director of development for the Rockefeller College and a director of corporate and foundation relations as well within the development office. So those are some new staffing moves there. Leadership transition issues, we finally, after almost a year and a half of thinking about this and attempting to hire someone, we have a new CFO, if you haven't heard in the last few days, Jim Van Voorst. We'll be starting July 1 as the Vice President for Finance and Administration. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank Steve Bettis for being the longest serving interim person in the history of higher education. Thanks, Steve, for his commitment and the dedication and the oversight that he's brought to that unit for much longer than he had anticipated when he became interim. So, Steve, thank you very much. And we'll be having the appropriate celebration of your transition in the weeks ahead, if not the months ahead.
Or the years at the
beginning. Or the years. Who knows? That's the right way of doing. Just a couple of other updates. We've made two offers for individuals as associate VPs and director of state and federal relations. We hope to be able to announce this publicly in late May. And so we are very pleased. There are some issues we're trying to work out with a couple of these appointments, and that's why we're not able to announce them right away. But this is also a critically important position for us. The Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs search will be getting underway in the next few days. We have finalized the search committee membership. We've identified the chairs and co-chairs, populated the committee. We thank the representatives across this university in all the critical areas. We don't have one of every kind because we insisted on having a committee of no more than 15 or 16. I think we said 15, but we actually ended up with 15, so 16. So that's done. And our goal is to convene this committee at least once or twice this month, and we're making it clear that people that join this committee must also be available to meet at least once or twice in the summer, because I'm absolutely adamant we will have a provost identified and hopefully hired by September. It may not start until January 1, but we've got to get this done, and we'll take working on this. The co-chairs are Dean Elgo Wolford and Jim Acker, who's a distinguished professor of the college and Collinsville. They're going to be the chairs and the co-chairs of this. We also have searches on the way for Vice Provost for International Education. And if you didn't hear, Dean Alan Lazat has announced his intention of retiring as the Dean of the School of Criminal Justice. So we'll have to launch that search probably sometime. We probably won't get it started until the fall. But he's identified the desire to transition either at the end of next academic year, if not sooner. So we'll be working on that. And just FYI, we will have another dean who plans to announce their retirement as well. We have people that are serving long and hard in these jobs, and they are coming to the point where they see now, they think it's now is the best time for them to transition as the university continues to move forward with a new strategic vision. So that's all that I'm going to say to you today. I think that's enough. We are really excited about the path that we have forward. And if you have any questions, I'll be pleased to answer.
Questions, anybody?
What is the nature of the engineering program? Is there any specialty, or is it just generic?
Well, this committee is looking at an array of engineering programs that meet high-need areas, particularly high-need areas that have been identified that are going to be needed in the state and in the region in the decades ahead. And so that's what they're focusing on. How can we build engineering programs that's going to provide the workforce, to meet the workforce needs? First one, computer engineering. Because we know for a fact that the data shows pretty clearly that the state of New York will have a need for 2,300 plus engineers each and every year for the next decade. And as you know, there's no public option for engineering in the capital region other than nanoscale engineering. And the private options are very, very costly. You have Union and RPI that are $42,000 a year, and they can't meet the needs and demands for all the engineers. We know firsthand because we've asked the employers, and they're telling us, why don't you start electrical and computer engineering, because we can't afford to hire all of our employees from RPI, because these young people have too many other options outside of the state, and a lot of them actually go outside of the state just because of the reputation of the institution and that kind of thing. So that's what we're going to be looking at. So we're probably going to be looking secondly at electrical engineering, biomedical engineering, and then there's something going to be on the side of big data, to tie this big data analytics as well. So we envision having somewhere between 5 to 7 programs that we bring in sequentially over the next 7 years or so. And I'm not bashful about it, not apologetic for it. My intended goal is to eventually have a college of science and engineering.
Just to follow up on Abner, this is quite a process, right? I mean, it's SED, it's SUNY, it's trustees. I mean, to really, is it middle states? Is there other external stuff that you have to?
It's all of the above. And but fortunately, it doesn't all have to happen at once. The whole accreditation piece is something that you do sequentially. You can, once a degree program is approved by the approval authority, which in this case will be the approval for us to develop the curriculum, and then they have to approve the program, you can start to offer the degree program. And then your accreditation process comes at the end of a specified time period. In some cases, it doesn't come until you graduate your first class. I started a Bachelor of Science in Health Sciences program in Minnesota, and it wasn't accredited until they graduated that first class, which was last year. And so sometimes it takes, as much as 3 to 4 years to get the accreditation piece of it. But yeah, we have to involve all of those agencies, the state ed department and all of it ultimately to get this approved. Well, one of the things that we have that has been achieved is that no longer is there a statute in the state ed that says we can't offer engineering degree program. And that's a big hurdle.
Do we imagine that the fact that we aren't going to immediately have accreditation and could take 3 or 4 years to get there will crimp the number of transfer students that we may get?
It has not been the experience of my experience in doing this. No, I don't think it's going to crimp the demand for students at all, because I think that there's significant demand, and the issue of accreditation becomes an issue if your institution you graduate from never receives it. But it's very rarely that you go down this path to do the work that's necessary to get accredited, and it doesn't happen, because you normally have to build a relationship, work your plans systematically through with the accrediting agency as you are building it. So in this case, it's not just middle states accreditation we're looking for. We have to get ABET accreditation, because a lot of the engineering, some of the engineering, when a program calls itself an engineering program, not all of them are ABET approved. And so that's the piece you also have to be concerned about. And we definitely want to have an ABET program that leads to students being licensed in whatever engineering program they're going to be graduating from.
Is there an option for conditional accreditation?
Sue is the expert on that. Julia, do you know?
I think that conditional only happens if you have accreditation and you lose it. Then it becomes conditional.
Before I left Minnesota, we were working with the other community college system to create something comparable to what we're talking about here that had more applied experiential learning, which is going to be a key part of what we do. And they started over 3 years ago, and so they have one more year to go before that program is accredited, and they've had no problem recruiting students because they've been working with ABET, and ABET has already given them very clear indication that if you do X, Y, and Z, you know it's going to happen sooner or later.
Robert, can you explain to me what ABED, the acronym, stands for?
Is the American Board of Engineering Technology, isn't it?
What's
it?
What American stands for? I'll look it up.
Yeah.
Google it. It's an engineering
instructor. It is, but I
thanks. Sorry to stump you.
I think it's, everybody just calls it ABED, so I've forgotten what the actual name is. It's ABED.
James, one is that where are you with, you're thinking about recruiting the foreign students? And the second one is on online offerings. What are your thoughts there?
I'm sorry?
Online
offerings. As a component of this?
Yes.
Online, we just got approved a complete program online in information technology, I think it is one of the new degree programs we got approved. I'm sure we will have some components of our engineering strategy that will be online. Stony Brook actually just initiated a complete electrical engineering program online, I think. It just got approved by the board as a part of the chancellor's open SUNY effort. Yes, sir.
ABED is an accreditation board for engineering and technology. Yeah.
Thank you.
And as opposed to straight online, you've done a combination of blending, in other words, where the class meets a period of time as opposed to all of our online.
Yeah, we will have both, strictly on some online courses and some blended courses clearly as a part of the strategy. Absolutely. The important thing that we want to build this program in a way that it has more applied learning than what a lot of contemporary engineering programs have. Because most programs now, a lot of classroom, a lot of theory, and what employers are complaining about there is not as much applied learning internships where a student graduates with a computer engineering degree. They've had a chance to work at IBM or Intel or someplace, and they have some practical knowledge. In fact, the chancellor is pushing all of the campuses to think differently about applied learning. She just had a symposium on it down in Washington, D.C. Last week, I think it was, the week before last. And some of the models that we're looking at in terms of, our goal is to do something different. It's not to create what Stony Brook, Buffalo, and Binghamton have, just for the sake of us having an engineering program. It has to be value-added. It has to have unique elements that's going to set us apart. And the applied learning component of it is one of those unique elements. It's going to look like a hybrid between Olin University, which is a private engineering school that started probably a decade and a half ago, that's very much steeped in applied learning. Olin is kind of like, in some ways, what we're, not exactly like now, but it would have been one of the models. Olin is freestanding, but they focus on engineering, so they get all their general ed requirements. As an Olin student, you take your gen ed requirements from any of the other institutions that they're working with, like Boston University or whoever is in the area the school wants to take their general ed requirements for. Then they take the upper division courses at Olin, and they have to do applied learning as a part of it before they graduate. It's an absolute requirement.
And I think that's critical. But I think what also is critical is that the model that you've established is that the word gets out, especially to the secondary school, but I know what you're looking for.
Right.
Because I think one of the biggest areas here, trying to get people to understand that if people from other places are coming to take the engineering jobs or whatever jobs are in this area, what is it for the kids who live here?
That's right.
And I think that's important, but they need to know it so they can start thinking a little differently. But you're looking for people who can do critical thinking, problem solving, independent learning, all those kinds of things are important. And if you don't do those, you'll have jobs available, right, and nobody to fill them.
And that's what exists today. There are more jobs than there are people to fill them. And the value added for what we're trying to build is, again, the experiential learning component that we're borrowing from Olin. And we're not just borrowing this in isolation. We actually have people from Olin that have been here who talked to us, part of a kind of an advisory group that's helping shape this. And then on the other side, we want to make sure that we're not just building an undergraduate engineering school, because that's not going to get you to where we need to be in terms of the other thing we've talked about and driving our sponsored research, hiring the best and the brightest faculty. You're not going to get that with an undergraduate engineering program only. And so ultimately the goal is to focus on getting building a strong engineering undergraduate effort, but then building a strong research and graduate education component on the back end, if you will, because you have to do this sequentially. You could start with just a graduate program, but that's much more difficult to build than starting out with undergraduates who may transfer to the graduate program. And so the other consultant we have around the table is the University of Illinois. The chairman of the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department is also part of the team that's helping us design this first effort. We plan, and we're also pulled together a external advisory group from some of the key employers in the area who have a vested interest in us providing this degree program. Because the other piece that I think is going to drive the enrollment, and once we get the word out, is the fact that people will begin to realize that there is an affordable option, a public option for engineering in the capital region. Because RPI can only take so many students. RPI is only interested in the upper crust of those that pass the exam and have the grade point average and the SAT scores to get into their engineering program. So this will provide a public option, and we certainly hope. We're not doing this just for sake of doing it. There's a strategic need. I think as a public institution, we have an obligation to try to meet, and it's going to help advance the profile of this university at the same time. So we're really excited about this, and you're going to be hearing more about the other programs that we plan to bring on incrementally as well.
I have a question actually regards to the search committee. The question is there any student representation or student input into that committee's process?
There will be opportunity for student input. There are no students on the committee. We thought about that, but as far as we could tell, there was, you know, we couldn't tell that that had been a historical practice. The other challenge was the fact that this group has to meet over the summer. But we will be making sure that there's an opportunity as a part of the interview process for student engagement and the rest of the university engagement in this important search process.
Will this be student be solicited through like the respective governing bodies, the SA and the GSA, or
It will be through that process, plus we will be providing opportunity for all staff, faculty, and students to provide input. This will be an open search. Okay, it's not going to be done quietly. It has to be confidential up until the point we identify the finalists. And that's the point where it becomes public, and that's the point where clearly you can't bring a provost in here there hasn't been an opportunity for students and other faculty and staff that are not part of the formal search committee to have some chance to provide their input and their opinion about which of those individuals is best qualified to do the job. I was very adamant that, we tried as best we could to have broad representation, but it's been my experience with search committees, if they get too large, it makes it virtually impossible to get anything scheduled. And to get anything done, we had that same experience with the DP for finance and finance and business search that we just finished. And so we tried to keep it as small and as nimble as possible, but clearly we want to articulate our desire to make sure this opportunity for everyone to provide feedback in terms of to really show up and be engaged, because that's the other thing I've emphasized, is that we have to put forth our best effort here to make sure people understand that we're serious about this. And when you bring a candidate in and you schedule a forum, you know, with whatever organization it might be, and only two people show up, it sends the wrong message to candidates. And I've seen that happen much too often around here. And so, do you want to add anything on that, Leanne? But that's kind of what we've done.
I think what the president has described is a strong general approach, and once the committee meets, I assume they will also add their own imprimatur to the process. But I can't imagine that we would not be fully inclusive of student engagement.
I'm just trying to understand at what point that input is going to occur, because on the one hand you said that you may have the individual selected by the end of the summer, but on the other hand there was concern with bringing a student in.
That's not what I said.
I must have misunderstood. So
what I said was we will have the finalists identified by the end of the summer.
Finalists. Four.
Yes.
Okay.
Won't be just one.
Okay.
We're not using that strategy. I expect there to be at least no less than, we may be two, but it definitely will be no more than three or four people we would be bringing to campus as finalists for this job.
And does this amount of applications, they become public at that point?
Yes. I'm insisting that they become public at this point because, this is the one position, you can argue, presidential search is like the one I was involved in. In the climate we live in today, people just won't come to the table if they have to be part of a kind of a beauty contest to get one of these leadership roles. It just doesn't work, because even out of this process, we must have noticed that two people actually lost their jobs because of that.
That's the basis of my question.
Yeah, two people lost their jobs. One of them was given an extension. He'll be losing his job at the end of this academic year because his name was leaked to the press. But at the chief academic officer level, more often than not, it has to be a public process, because that's where, faculty, the governance structure, the union, students, all constituents need to have some engagement with the decision-making process. And we made it clear I think Joette very early, my first conversation with the governor's folks, the University Senate, that we, and I had the same feedback in dialogue with Brett Benjamin from UUP, that we intended for this process to be open once the initial vetting of candidates is done, that only those individuals who are willing for their names to become public will be moving forward in the process at that point.
And it's potential that that would win the field, but it's something that has to be done.
It potentially will limit the field perhaps more for someone that's a provost at another institution who may be looking to upgrade their status by coming to you all meeting. But for anyone else that's a dean, which is where you were probably looking first, you're looking for someone that's a dean or an assistant or associate provost to be the individuals that would be in line. And at that level, the confidentiality is not, I mean, you're expected to, it's kind of expected. But Board of Trustees get a little concerned when they know that their chief executive officer is out trolling around for other opportunities. They don't like that very much.
But the person can opt out at that point.
I'm sorry.
I mean, the person could opt out theoretically at that point.
Yeah.
But
what you do, Mike,
they have a really good check.
Yes. What we do with these search firms, Michael, is we make it very clear to the potential candidates about the rules of engagement and where confidentiality will be adhered to and at what point we will have to go public. And people can make a decision on the front end whether or not they want to be part of the process.
Right.
What about, I was actually going to ask a similar question, not about student participation, but about council participation in the process. I mean, I don't know how others feel, but I'd actually be interested in meeting, meeting with the finalists.
And that will be part of the interview schedule that we put in place when we bring these 2 to 4 people to campus, is making sure that they're here for at least probably it's going to have to be about a day and a half for each and every one of them. Coming in at night before, spending a whole day here if necessary, and then maybe even.
We're also happy to host in New York if they want to come to New York instead.
Okay. Well, we certainly appreciate this.
Always
input. This is an important search. This is one of the most important searches we will be running at this university. And it's important that people feel that it's been an open search and that if they've had an opportunity to be engaged in the vetting and the decision-making process.
I've never been part of this, so I'm interested to see it from the other side of academics. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not sure how you make it. I'm interested to see how you actually make a decision with all of those different parties weighing in with different perspectives as to how you actually decide. What's the criteria for council and students? And
well, I guess the first question is who makes the decision?
That would be me.
Okay.
So
because
that's one
that
way
means
it becomes it will not be a committed decision.
I'm much more comfortable with that.
You know, I'm
so participatory.
All these different groups are
not a democracy.
You, they're data points for you.
Absolutely.
Right.
You,
right.
At the end of the day, you make your evaluation.
Let me be clear about how I'm accustomed to doing this, and I plan on doing it the same way, where we have a mechanism where we will be collecting written input from anyone that's had a chance to visit with the candidates through the public forums or individualized meeting. If they're meeting with SA or they're meeting with the graduate student, they're meeting with the union of government, the Senate, or whoever, that they will have a written document where, according to the job description, they can give that feedback about strengths and weaknesses. I made it clear for the search committee that that's their job. They are to do the search. They're not the hiring authority.
Right.
What I expect them to do is to submit to me a list of candidates. And I'm telling them, if you don't want the person to be hired, if you don't think they're qualified, then don't put a name on the list. Because when I get a list of anywhere between 2 and 4 finalists that are going to be brought to the campus, that's the pool from which I will be making a hiring decision. And that will be based on the collective written input that we get. And what I also like to do is to pull us, after that input is in, is to pull a few stakeholders again to kind of debrief about the written responses that we have seen, go through the written responses. And it's an opportunity for me to have a roundtable discussion. Hopefully there'll be someone from this body
that's helping, giving me input about what do you think about these three or four items. And then after that, I have to make a decision about the person that I think is best qualified to lead the academic vision of this university for. So that is the process.
And I think that that's one of the problems that we've faced over the last few years, that when the term shared decision making is thrown out there, people don't understand precisely what you've just said, is that you're making a recommendation as opposed to making a final decision. And a lot of times they get confused with that. They get upset at the end of the line because it wasn't clear to them, probably in their own mind, you know, it could have been made clear. Yeah. Is that they're just making a recommendation, that you're doing a screening process.
That's
right. This is the ultimate decision. And that's important because the person you're dealing with hiring you is the person that's going to work with you personally.
Absolutely.
And also put your vision in place. So you've got to be comfortable with that person. Bottom line.
That is the bottom line.
That's right. Maybe an opportunity for the council also being one step removed to help in any recruiting that you don't want to necessarily get involved in or others on the search committee, and I think the chair and others could be
Absolutely.
Helpful in that.
Absolutely. Okay.
Any other questions of the president? Okay. I don't see Clara.
Clara's not here.
So there is no report that she
did not give me a written report either.
Okay. Then the other updates, the faculty, Joy.
Yes. Yes, I'm pleased to pleased to be here for my final meeting.
Already?
I know.
You just got here.
I know. Well, that's actually something that we were talking about on Gov, how short our service is with this council. I finally am understanding what's going on here, and I am going to move on to be the chair of the University Senate next year. And perhaps you'd enable me to come back with the vice chair. Maybe that's something that you might consider. I'm pleased to announce as well that we, with the President's office, put together a survey on shared governance and assessment here. It was, there was one version very similar to, as anyone was also part of the process, can attest to, for both students, and then another version for faculty, staff, professional staff, and every level. So that one just went out last week and is still in the process. And we kind of left the student one out for any last comers. So we're pleased by that, just to get a pulse on what the faculty and staff and students' perception of the Senate is at this particular point. And then moving forward, we are hoping to get faculty and students and staff more engaged in the university. Because as the president pointed out, there are many times when the faculty are asked to provide input and they haven't been responsive. So one of my main goals next year is to get a more responsive faculty, staff, and student body, and Caitlin is actually helping me with that as well.
We would love to hear about that. That's all done and you draw your conclusions and wrap it up with whatever you're comfortable providing.
Definitely. That's also part of the transparent process.
Right.
I think faculty need to see that and the students as well. I mean, that's really, we've been telling people, even if you don't know anything about the Senate or the councils, that's information for us, and maybe we need to do a better job of educating faculty and staff and students. But sure, yes.
Any questions?
This was 2 weeks ago, was the shared governance, first shared governance conference.
Yes.
That Susan and I attended for two days. Part of ACT, but also an excellent program at the conference. It's interesting to see that some councils do not have faculty representatives at their meetings, and I think that when Albany came up that faculty make a report, etc., I think it was very very positive toward our council engagement and look forward to other shared governance. So.
Right. Cynthia Fox will be attending regularly next year, but I'm always willing to be invited back. Thank you.
Garrett?
So rather than read the report which you all have in front of you, I'm going to basically go through it quickly and summarize and update it. So one of the issues that had headed the report was that in the GSA, we've been having various issues with the University Auxiliary Services in terms of constantly changing rules and procedures, issues with regards to the tax code, and so on. Recently, GSA was able to finally get a meeting with UAS to attempt to work through some of these. They admitted that they were responsible for certain failures in communication, and they made certain promises in terms of how they're going to try and rectify various issues that we've had in terms of the rules of what documentation graduate students need to put forward in terms of their activities and what they need to use in order to get paid from university activity fees, as well as our issues with the tax code and so on. They're going to work those out supposedly over the next couple of months. If anyone has questions about that, those are actually probably better directed towards Caitlin, who's the GSA president, who's here. The GSA had an assembly, actually two assembly meetings in which they discussed bylaws, and they managed to pass some, but not all of the proposed bylaws. So they have a fairly functional set of bylaws, albeit not necessarily fully complete, but it's getting there and should be there pretty shortly, because they're being very systematic in making sure everything is in place and proper rather than jumping the gun. Everything will be very well vetted. The presidential forum, generally, everyone feels that went over very well from graduate student end. The discussion could get a little heated at times, but in general, the feeling is very, very positive in that we had another very positive engagement where graduates were actually able to discuss major concerns with the university president in a way that makes them feel like their concerns are actually being heard and that some progress is being made towards dealing with the issues that are important to them. And the final thing that I wish to discuss is that the GSA elections were recently concluded, in which admittedly our turnout was less than stellar, but
makes me feel totally illegitimate.
but at the same time the elections were held. There was no serious issues with their conduct. So at the end of the day, Caitlin's going to continue to be president. The vice president will continue in her term, but all the other officers will be new officers for next year. That includes myself, who I'm not able to continue or rerun due to term limits, so this will be my last meeting with you. And I think that concludes my report. I don't see Brian. So I was hoping I could introduce him, but I will not be able to do so. My successor next year will be Brian Barksdale. And I will put him in direct touch with the council, so that way if anyone needs anything after my term ends at the end of May, we can reach him.
Great.
Thank you.
Any questions, Pierre? No? Tim?
Well, I'll hand out a printed version of the report that was included in your packets. The Alumni Association is having a good year, for which I bear very little responsibility, but will take all the credit. As good presidents tend to do. Last weekend, we had our annual award ceremony. The awardees are listed in the report. 14 alums who ranged in age, I would guess, from maybe 25 to 90-something, who have been active in their fields of service. And in their commitment to the university, I thought it was a terrific event. We somehow forced the president of this campus to fly off to Georgia, give an address at his alma mater, and somehow get back here in time to do the same thing again at night at our event. It was very nice. We, at the end of April, held our very first UAlbany Connects Capital District meeting in at LaSalle in downtown Albany. It attracted a pretty wide range of alums. I'm an alum of the class of 2015. You can't hardly get more current than that. And alums from as far back as 1947. So. It was an interesting crowd. There was a lot of excitement about what's going on at the university. I think that kind of mirrored what happened earlier in the year when we had a similar UAlbany Connects New York Metro meeting at Hearst Tower in New York. I think both of those events have gone a long way toward helping us establish a new program of connecting and reconnecting with alums who maybe have not heard from the university in a while. And it's a nice way to bring them in without immediately reaching into their pockets, but in fact, offering them a variety of options for coming back, volunteering with the various schools and in their fields of study. We get a lot of deans and some faculty at the events, which is really helpful. The dean of the School of Business, who's any of you have met him, know is a dynamo. And from the Rockefeller School and the dean from the College of Arts and Sciences and the School of Social Work were there. So it was, they were very good events. We've gotten huge positive feedback on them. And we're going to be doing a lot more of them in the future. So at least from the alumni side of the house, it looks pretty up. So.
Questions? So I've got a question that borrow a little bit of our time because it's personal, but it's business. Do we run any programs for groups that want to come back and reunite? The reason I ask the question is, it's my 30th anniversary, my 30th reunion this year. So a group of us who went to school here, I'm right to say, are going to reunite here in Albany.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you must have some program.
Yes, we do.
That facilitates that. So we have a program.
Yeah, yeah. If you contact Lee or Melissa Samuels in his office, we have a reunion program. So people who want to get together like that, we help fund those things. We help make the arrangements on campus if that's where they want to meet. And we also do affiliate groups. So we have a group, for example, for Five Quad, people who worked at Five Quad. And,
oh, nice.
You know, maybe 3 weeks ago, I gave a welcoming address to a group of rugby alumni who were getting together.
Well,
it's an interesting group.
Rugby, we can't beat that. I'll be leaving my university council president business card in the car.
I've talked to a lot of groups over the last 40 years, and the rugby guys were interesting is the word.
Interesting.
I had a great time, and I think they did too. But.
Well, thank you. I'll talk to you offline, but I'm glad that we have those.
Yep, we do.
I want to quickly, if there's nothing more on updates, go into our new business. And I'm going to talk very briefly about a consent agenda. But before I do that, how many people are familiar with a consent agenda? A couple of you. Because consent agendas are done in a variety of manners, depending on the business at hand and the governance structure, but often they're done where the people that are presenting, you want to, if it's an information conveyance, that information conveyance is done in a written report. Written reports are then all taken together, and a singular motion is put up to approve all of it. If there's something on a particular written report, anyone can take an item or a report off the consent agenda. If not, the consent agenda is acted upon in total. This streamlines the meeting, providing more time for discussion and interaction, which is what we believe to be the most effective part of what we can do and how we can have the greatest impact. So I wanted to get people's opinion on that approach to these meetings, and if it's something that you would consider moving forward with. Any questions, comments?
I think that that's generally a good approach. I think that anything, like in the case of my report, I was able to give it in 2 to 3 minutes by updating what was there, as opposed to having to deliver it all from scratch, which might have taken 10 or 15 minutes after questions and so on. And I think that anything that expedites report giving allows people to digest things in advance as possible.
Yeah, there is a condition responsibility that you need to read it in advance. So we will get the information to you in plenty of time, but you do make the commitment that you're going to read the reports that are given. But what happens in that case, if the writer of the report feels there's something that they specifically need input on or emphasis or add emphasis to that isn't in the report, they could pull it off But oftentimes those reports are just accepted if there is nothing that requires interaction. Is there any objection to trying that over the next couple of meetings?
No.
Okay, great, man. Then we'll do that. Enrollment Management 101. No pun intended.
That would be my call. So thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about this. What we put together for you is a bird's eye view of enrollment at the campus. Everything from sparking that twinkle in a prospective student's eye, all the way through how long it takes people to finish and move on to their way. So as you might imagine, there's a lot of stuff in between those two points. So it'll be fairly high level this time. Certainly at a university like ours, there's a substantial undergraduate engagement in this enrollment, and there's also a very substantial graduate engagement. Very different worlds, graduate and undergraduate. So our enrollment team, which I brought with me today, includes our Associate Vice Provost for Enrollment Management, Bob Andrea, and our Vice Provost for Graduate Education, Kevin Williams. I believe we have a PowerPoint ready to roll. And this is the bird's eye view, so I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Sue, and thank you very much for having us.
This is the Bob Andrea part.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
And as Sue mentioned, this is a real high-level presentation that Kevin and I have put together for you with the hope to perhaps maybe we could come back and each one of these topics that we're going to cover could be a session in and of itself. So I want to move quickly. I'll talk about the undergraduate piece, and then Kevin will move in and come up and speak about the graduate. We've organized it in this manner. We think it's important to talk
about before you use that, sorry.
We've organized it in this manner that we'd like to first frame a little bit about who our students are, because that informs a lot of the decisions that we make relative to our the data we gather and the recruitment and activities that we put into place and the kinds of things that we need to think about. And then we're going to take you through how we recruit students, admit students, how they're aided, and of course, how we retain students. So first, let's talk about our students. This table shows you the distribution of undergraduate and graduate students. About 75% of our total enrollment each year would be under the undergraduate piece, and about another 25% from graduate, fairly consistent, as you can see. The new inputs each fall, and I might add, Kevin and I, we were just trying to decide how we should approach this. We thought the best way to, we're going to focus on the fall 2013 enrolling class. All the data we're going to throw in front of you is going to be relevant to that group. So these are the new inputs that particular year. So now let me tell you a little bit about the undergraduates. About two-thirds of the new students that come in the fall are going to be freshmen, but another third, and a significant portion, are going to be transfer students. They presented in the fall about a 3.4 GPA for 1142 mean SAT, ACT, and the transfer GPA was a 3.0. We're split pretty evenly, male-female. We've been actually growing on the split has been growing a little bit larger, favoring the male side recently. And that's our student diversity broken out by domestic and international.
So before you go,
yes.
Could I just say, I assume you don't have a SAT score for the transfer students because it's not required by some of the community colleges?
That's correct, yes. And when I get to the slide about how we admit, you'll see if a student competes essentially as a transfer student based on what they've done at the college level.
So that GPA is from their other college, not from their high school.
Correct. Where they come from, the undergraduate distribution, you can see broken up by freshmen and transfers, about 88% from New York State, with an increasing number students coming out of state, both domestic and internationally. The progress to date has been encouraging, where this fall freshman class had about 12% more from domestic, non-New York, than the previous year, and international combined total freshman transfers about 11%. Within New York State, you can see this slide reflects how the regions are distributed. Better than 70% of our freshmen are coming from downstate, and then we've got almost the flip side on the transfer, which, as you might expect, is much more of a local population, with about 45% coming from the capital region. For those of you that are visual like me, This gives you the county by counties for freshmen and transfers of our New York State. We've always been proud of the distribution within New York State. This year, we are 59 of the 62 counties. You see the gaps there, and then we've got our transfer students who are much more local.
Is this by design, or
it's design?
Is this by design, or do you recruit more on the island? Do you zip code? Do you?
We know where our track record has been historically. We get most bang for our buck. We've had the best the monies in Long Island, the mobilities in Long Island, and Westchester, and the city. So that's where we spend quite a bit of our time. But we have admissions representatives throughout the state. Probably doing a little bit less in Western New York than we are in the Westchester, Long Island area. But we take a look at past applications first and foremost, and we try to make our decisions based on that. And by state, you can see the distribution. For our domestic students right now, the distribution is going to be in the Northeast. As I've mentioned, I'm trying to grow our out-of-state population, and we have plans in place.
Isn't it fair to say, though, that really all this diversity, I bet you half of this diversity comes from athletics?
Not
from football, lacrosse, basketball.
Yeah, I wish I could say that they're all their team members were from out-of-state, but
follow me. We were just saying that, a lot of these kids that are coming from out of New York are recruited deliberately from out of New York.
Sure.
So how much of a percentage of the out-of-state people are actually non-athletic people?
I don't have that for you, but I can get that for you.
You'd agree it's probably a pretty good number.
Less than half, I would think. I think athletics are going to be exactly.
If it wasn't for athletics, we wouldn't have all this. That's what I'm getting at.
Let me get that number for you. There is no doubt they're an important part of our out-of-state efforts, and it fluctuates, for instance, year to year, depending upon how many recruits they need.
Right.
But let me get that. Steve, I'll send that to you.
Good.
That data to you.
And that's a good thing.
No, it's a very important piece to that enrollment puzzle. And then for the next slide, you can see the distribution for our international students. Like many...
There's the basketball player in the
lacrosse guys are in Canada.
And you find it's Australia.
Lacrosse is Canada.
I think the guy in the street, that was the soccer player.
And on that previous slide,
that's what I was getting at.
One student from Minnesota, believe it or not.
But this again gives you a distribution of where our international students are coming. When we're trying to construct a class, we look at the transfers also, and you can see where within that transfer pool, there's two separate avenues or places where they're coming from. About two-thirds are from our feeder community colleges, and you see a list of them there. And then about a third are coming from four-year institutions. And here's just a partial list of the top four-year public and private institutions that we enrolled students from as transfers. We had over 200, almost 200 four-year institutions in fall 2013 in enrolling students. So it's a pretty broad spectrum.
These are students who
went there with the intention of transferring ultimately, or something happened, the degree program wasn't what they wanted. What are the drivers for transfer from those 4 years?
Well, I would say the community colleges, obviously there was a purpose, yeah, but here, I would say on the private side, it was, a combination could be that there could be money and the major, and it could be that among the publics that they may have went there with an idea of transferring. I think most of the students that come back our way, if you took a look at it, Robert, would be a lot of these students come back closer to home, and at least on the public side.
Sure. I know at Siena College, my daughter attends Siena, and it's very frequently mine, where people that she knew that have dropped out and have driven across town.
Sure.
Yeah. And I've known a couple of people who applied here, got rejected, went to Oswego or Geneseo for a year or two, and then transferred. So.
And the last slide about our students was to inform our decision about Shrewsbury and are the area academic areas of interest that they come with. Freshmen on the left, you can see a little bit more on or less directed than the transfers on the right, with the most popular concentration on the incoming class at about 23% undecided. The transfer students obviously having gone someplace else and experienced the 1, 2, 3 semesters are much more direct.
What's the difference between biology and human biology?
I'm sorry?
I just noticed you have biology and human biology as two separate.
Two different majors. Two different areas.
Okay.
That's another story.
You'll be hearing a lot about human biology. So.
Well, it would be the one that would concern me more than
wood free health.
What?
Yeah.
So with that as a backdrop, but the first graduates.
Which one is which?
Human biology. Human biology.
Let's talk.
Never mind. Sorry.
Let's talk about the recruitment strategies in place currently to try to enroll the class. Each year we go in with goals, enrollment targets established both in terms of numbers and as well as geography, diversity, and quality measures. But you can boil down the recruitment effort into two areas. The goal is to go out and generate qualified applications that we can translate into positive admissions decisions, and ultimately enroll a class through yield activities that we can be pleased with. So
Buckland, do you have more specific metrics? What are those goals? And I don't need them in individual, but
yeah.
I'm assuming have more specific goals.
Sure. We can start with the enrollment target this year's. Fall 2013, the class of 2550, for instance, a certain percentage would be from out of state. Dr. Jones is, we're really trying to move towards doubling our out of state enrollment, both in East domestic and international. So, any one number, but for a given year, like for instance, I've set 5% targets for undergraduate admissions out of state.
Are there other things, though, out of state, international, are there other geographic goals within New York State? Are there other types of goals that we use? Or is it just the number in those primary goals?
I think it's the primary goal is the enrollment. I mean, we'll go in, and every year we say we'd like to get more Western New York students. But we're battling not only the competition from some of the smaller privates out there, but also the economy is not doing as well up in Western New York. So so each year, I kind of laughed on the cheek, but those three gaps in the counties, we'd like to be able to say that we have a student from every county in New York State. But at the end of the day, we're measured by, did we hit our enrollment target?
Does the state or even the senior trustees or whoever, do they ever hand down any goals to us?
They do for the president's report card. And there's a bunch of them. But they're not only involved enrollment, but involved.
I mean, like, could they swoop in and say, we need you to have 3,000 students and do whatever it takes to get, I mean, I don't know, whatever.
Board of Trustees doesn't tend to weigh in on the admissions. We do have an extensive conversation with them about what our enrollment is going to be, because they use it for budget planning. Their most intense focus, though, is on retention and success and graduation. So, and those figures, they will ask a campus to say, so what are you going to do to improve your retention rate?
Okay.
Which actually, we have a good story on that.
I was just wondering, since we know there's, for example, this engineering need that, you know, I could see somebody swooping down and saying, thou shalt create, you know, go out, recruit and create more engineering students. Yeah.
They do have that initiative, but it doesn't come with thou shalt. It comes with a care.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
In New York?
Yes. Yes.
Sorry, small cap. Sometimes I actually
say
what I
think. It worked. We went after the carrot. We got two programs.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's how we got the engineering program. So to summarize the recruitment activities that we're going to talk a little bit about each one of these, going into every recruitment cycle, we're looking at outreach. We're trying to develop communication plans and also trying to drive them to campus with on-campus programs. So we'll talk a little bit about each one. When I say outreach, it's actually physically the professional staff and admissions. About 15 professionals are out and about, boots on the ground, visiting high schools, attending college nights and college fairs, or developing their own events like regional receptions, whether in the fall or the spring, to try to reach the students in their own backyard. Our international recruiters will add to that those about three avenues: embassy visits, as well as visiting agents that we've partnered with to try to help with our enrollment efforts internationally.
Do we pay these agents a fee based on how many people we hire or bring in?
It's a per student fee. Yes, they are currently getting 10% of the. Semester tuition that the students enrolled for that very first year.
And there's no FCPA issue with that?
What is FCPA?
Yeah,
Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Oh, that.
Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
I'm not. This was vetted through the SUNY system and an RFP.
It's a SUNY program.
It's a SUNY program.
SUNY program.
SUNY girls.
Yeah.
I think all of these recruiters have to be on some approved and pre-vetted list.
Right. I mean, that's just a big hot area right now. That's how you're paying the foreign people, it's really being looked at.
I was wondering, too, about an outreach in terms of coordination with the Alumni Association. It would seem to me you got a bunch of recruiters right there at hand you could use in each all over the place.
And we do that weekly for college nights and college fairs. We have about 100 alumni. That we reach out to in the fall and the spring to try to cover areas or join us at programs if it's convenient for them. We also have partnered, and I think it's in your brochure too, where Lee Cerevello and his people will help us with accepted student receptions in the springtime throughout the state. We've done a lot more out of state with, Lee's been very helpful that way too. So. We do track, and one of the things I'm trying to stay at a high level, but to let you know that we track just about everything down in the undergraduate admissions. These are the New York State travel by the professional staff, the contacts, the outreach that you saw listed on the previous slide. That's the volume we're currently at. We're at the 13, and you can see where we are on 14. Excellent. And you can also see the commitment that we've made to non-New York travel. For now, we're up to 4 full-time people who are dedicated to recruiting out of state, plus 3 part-timers. To frame that a little bit, that's a recent. The fall of 14 was the first time we had a national recruiter, somebody that is going beyond just the Northeast region. Up in fall of 2011, we had 1.5 people out of state, and you can see what has been occurring since the last couple of years. spectrum. And finally, on tracking the travel by country, again, we've added another full-time international recruiter. She speaks three languages. She's from China. You can see when she, prior to Cynthia joining us, we were in four countries and able to. We had one person, John Pomeroy, covering that initiative. The last couple of years since we've had Cynthia, we've not only increased the quantity of our visits, but we've also now, if you count on that, that was about 18 different countries that we're now in. So it's a breadth as well as a volume.
Last couple of slides, these have shown the number. So this is the number of students recruited from each.
No, this is just some type of contact. It's a visit. It's a college night. It's an agent. It could be joining Dr. Jones and some type of for an MOU signing, etc. This is not a student count.
Is there a graph that correlates this with the number of students in any given year? Recruited from their visits?
I didn't put in an application, but as I mentioned in the previous slide, we've almost doubled our fall international student enrollment since we started to engage. We've gone from 65 fall freshmen to 118 so this fall, as of right now, we're projecting about 150 international students for fall 2018.
What I'm saying is that if you put them next to each other, you might be able to identify, you know, what areas are the visits recruiting the most students on a per-visit basis and be able to say, okay, if the others aren't recruiting as many per visit, why not be able to look at that and hopefully increase the diversity accordingly?
That's the strategy we use in the domestic side, particularly in New York, because we're really experiencing that, quite honestly. And you can see here we've gone from that 268, went down to 240. Yeah, there was travel time. We're getting even more strategic. I think that's what you're trying to get at. What your question is that, you know, as we get more familiar with what it takes and what we need to do, you'll see, you won't see the number perhaps decrease, but you'll see us eliminate some countries along the way, or maybe go to countries every other year that, rather than make them a regular visit.
Well, those students, three years, 4 years.
Yeah, we do. And when you talk the retention, we measure all of the cohorts. We look at the overall retention and graduation rate as well as international students. This past year, returned at a similar rate to freshman to sophomore year, which is about 81.5%. And the graduation rate has been consistently at the smaller numbers, around 64%.
And your last question is that, and I know this is very difficult. Many times when you have a student with a working family or student who might leave and go to another institution, do you have any way of getting any kind of exit interview or information from why they might have switched, that kind of thing?
I've got a little bit on that. Because you're at the mercy of
if they won't tell you.
Yeah, we've got a little bit on that.
So there's no Central European representation?
Not to date, no.
See, this is where I would use the alumni on these long, you know, leverage the folks that are wherever they've scattered to. Just economically, it seems to me that would be a great way.
Or it could be because universities in Europe support their students so well that they don't feel the need to come here and pay. But maybe.
How robust is your web-based recruitment? Our virtual tours are. You know, I have a son who will be at a university next year. Much of what he and all of his friends did were online.
Yeah, the international. Our web piece for the international needs to be developed.
How about domestic?
It's not bad. We have we've actually been waiting for a lot of the construction to stop. There's a vendor out there called my College Guide that will really give you a sizzling presentation for the campus. Until that found is ready. We want to be able to show ourselves in the best possible light. So we've got plans for that. yeah, you know, we nothing.
I think that's great that you have plans, because that's, these kids are doing their screening that way, so when they get the big list down to the short list, one of the ways that they do that is the web-based program.
Yeah. We've done, you know, we've done a lot more, and I don't know, with chat, and we've done a lot more with trying to engage students electronically, but the visual piece on the virtual tour piece, which I think we're talking about, is on, we're just waiting for the last piece for the recruitment activities I mentioned is the communications piece, and that entails a combination of the leads that we generated through these outreach efforts, and the students have contacted us through either the web or through sending their test scores, or we've bought their names, and or you are utilizing third-party vendors. This past fall of 13, we purchased over 70,000 names to the College Board of the SAT. Those of you who've had children that have gone through the college search process, you know that without mail, that's it. Right now, I think the going rate is about 37 cents a name. But this fall, we've purchased over 100,000 names, expanding our geographic outreach to try to add some targeted communications there. There's a series of print, email, and other types of communication. Down at the bottom, we're also contacting, we have a fairly robust telecounseling program, which is becoming a little bit more, I don't know, those of you who sit at home and don't answer the phone when there's a telecounselor, well, you can imagine for the prospective students, that's the same case. But that yields about 21 of the calls that we make actually contact students and reach them and have our students answer their questions. Our yield is about 21-22% enrolling. I mentioned the chat features, and of course Skype, particularly for our international recruiters, has become increasingly important. Not only to exchange interview information and answer questions, but also to test their language skills. Because that sometimes doesn't translate all of the something like the TOEFL. And then finally, the on-campus programs. Remember, I mentioned to you, we want to drive them to the campus, we want to get them here. We have a daily visit program, which during the school year when we're in session is 6 days a week. We host group visits. The fall open house, 2,000 people will come to campus. At the prospect stage, in the fall of 2012, for that class, about 41% of the students that we admitted in that class actually enrolled. So that's a pretty good yield. The spring one in that particular year for admitted students that weekend, we had over 4,000 visitors, students and parents, and we yield 68% of the students that come to the open houses. So again, high importance to us to try to help us with our enrollment efforts.
What's our from accepted students to admit? What is our
right now? It's running around 21.5, 22. You see that one on the slides there too. But and this is our daily visit tabulation. Again, as I mentioned to you, we really try to track everything. You can see what we're doing throughout the year. The 51% of our visitors apply to the university, and then we're enrolling, of those that are admitted, we're enrolling about 34% of them. So that's we really want to get them to campus. We really want to get them here so we can help them better understand them. And then finally, and this goes back to the whole idea of what's the most effective, and what we add and what we don't. This slide reflects the first source of the inquiry at the top grouping, and those are the top six areas. The second slide reflects those of the first source inquiries, what were the most, where to get the most enrollments out of it. Two things I'll mention before I want the application. No matter what we do, they don't want to sign up until they apply. This is a national phenomenon. Schools are the first time that we actually connect officially in our prospect database is at the time that their application. I could have bought their name. I could have seen them at their high school. They could have been on our web page. But that figure, it drives the admissions folks crazy. How do we get to those people before the application? And then the other thing that we do, university and high school here at the university is very active and very well known. Over 200 high schools are offering the program where we give University of Albany credit. But we take, if you sign up for University of High School, Albany course at Gilderland High School, it gets added into the University of Albany's prospect database. So we begin to mail to those students while they're juniors and seniors if they've taken this course. So we get them to apply. We get them applied. Next slide, Sue. Now we get into the admissions phase of the decision, and this just recaps where we've been the last 4 years with applications. We've seen a slight growth in our applications, even with the declining demographics, in part for our increased applications from out of state and international. The fall 14, I debated whether to throw it in there now. It's still not complete. We are running actually about 1% ahead this year than last year for applications for fall 2014. The admit rate, the yield, Mike, that you had, we're about 21.3. You can see how that's has been fluctuating. Our enrollment target actually has grown, so that's one of the reasons the admits have gone up. In fact, actually, 2011 to 2020 to now, it's 2550 has been the fall freshman class.
What's a good number? Yield.
Yield?
And there's got to be national benchmarks.
Well, for a public, I was looking at Binghamton's. Binghamton's is about right around where we are. It really depends where you are in your competitor mix. For instance, you go to the most highly selected institution, of course, they're going to yield at a significant rate. But, depending upon who we're going up against for these students, that's going to put us in the first choice, second choice, third choice. That's kind of that measurement. So. But I was actually, 20, it's been around for us, 23, going down steadily over the last few years.
Is that because we're, kind of rebounding from a recession,
It's the crazy competition that's out there for this student enrollment. I didn't bring it because, again, we could spend a whole day on financial aid. I have scholarship letters that would just absolutely boggle your mind from institutions that that cost $50,000 that when they get done with their scholarship package are actually cost less than the university at all. So,
I was thinking that maybe it was financial savings.
Well, yes, but it's not necessarily. It's just that it's that idea that the plane doesn't go. No one pays the same price on the plane,
right,
for that seat. And if you don't bring in, it's actually net of revenue. Yes, it's a cost, but it's net of revenue for many of these private institutions. So they don't give the money; they're not going to get the money. And this just goes through, our admissions policy has been approved by the University Senate. It's a holistic review. The admissions office will read in teams. There's about four teams down there. They have about 5,600 applications per team. They start with the high school record and evaluate not only the performance in the class, but the strength and rigor of the program, move into standardized test scores, and then round out things based on recommendations and other information that's happening.
Do you assign weights to these different components?
We do not. No. There's no number that gets assigned to any of our applicants. There's kind of like a sliding scale rather than GPA, SAT, but all applicants are reviewed and evaluated.
So can I ask you a question on that?
Sure.
This may be completely not applicable, but are there numbers such that you can automatically admit?
Sure.
So in my world, when I do a screen and I see that his credit score is 800, I don't care about anything else, and I send him a thing saying,
you are pre-approved for a $50,000 line of credit. Can we?
That's the same in our business. I'll even take you once I was at a presentation at a conference with someone from one of Princeton, Janet, said that there is even within her pool an applicant that is an automatic admit. And she said this in addressing the guidance counselors and said, you may spend hours on this recommendation, and I spend 8 minutes on the application itself. So I think that whereas the unwashed middle, you're agonizing over and reviewing and sending it through the process, your business practice is no different than what we do.
You didn't but talk can, about that in that movie admission.
But can we buy data and send out approvals? So in other words, before my son, and he's not in any of these categories.
basically saying if you apply, you will be approved.
You know, it's more like publisher clearinghouse type letters. You know, it's been a there are schools doing that, but I've chosen not to do that. What we will do is though, when we buy the names and they a self-reported GPA with PSAT scores, they'll get an email that says that you may be eligible for a scholarship and an honors college, etc. If you read between the lines, if you're ready to make that commitment, you have to think that you're going to be a good candidate. But I've not gone out and said you're admitted. Maybe. I mean, I'm always open for. 5 years ago, if you asked me if I was going to be working with agents, I wouldn't have necessarily thought that the case. But
or maybe it triggers even a phone call from somebody in their community, an alum, or someone they might even know.
So that's probably Princeton. Princeton even has this.
Absolutely.
Where they would admit somebody.
Now, how many? But they absolutely do.
So it would be geography. It would be test score. It would be.
She didn't.
Test score legacy.
She didn't go into that.
Athletic prowess.
But her point was, if you saw that movie, it definitely didn't give that impression.
The point with the question from the guidance counselor.
Everything I know, I learned in Hollywood, funny. Right?
The idea that SUNY is floating on free tuition, STEM, top of the class, students, etc. go through the same admissions process, and who pays the tuition if they don't?
That is still to be determined. In fact, that Diane and I were talking about that earlier this week. The way it's going to be folded out is they have to complete the course. They have to complete the STEM. And every semester, they'll go in and determine whether or not you qualify for that STEM grant as to who's responsible.
Oh, David Switch.
Going after it with a phone call may actually be more effective than based on this. If I get someone ever calling me or emailing me saying you may be eligible for, I'm immediately like suspicious when I see may be eligible in any context. I think that's probably pretty true. Kids who are coming up and getting emails of that sort. Whereas if they get a phone call, so apparently the phone call conversion rate is very, very good. If they get a phone call from either an alumni or they get a phone call from a school official saying,
or a neighbor,
you will be admitted if you apply.
A friend of their parents.
I think that'll come across very, very loudly because I know, I did it. It was a while ago for me, but I still remember all the anxiety of going through the application process. And there are going to be a lot of students, even those who are at the who really could have their pick of a large number of different schools, who are going to hear from a school that they go, oh, that's a very, very solid school, I know that, and will go with that as a safe bet rather than go through the anxiety of trying to choose. And they may, at that point, lock in here.
This is good discussion, folks.
We need that big data program to move on this quickly.
quickly, similar chart as so the previous one for transfer admissions. There's one of the things to note is you can see the transfer, particularly since we're 2/3 community colleges, they're becoming impacted by the geographic downswing, particularly in New York State. You can see how our applications have trended down over the last couple of years. They don't have the benefit in most of them, although they're struggling, they're trying to add housing options. They don't have the benefit, most of them, for residential. And so we've taken a hit in our applications there.
We still haven't been able to hit our enrollments. It'd be right around 1,400 enrollments for the entering classes.
2014 looks a little different, though.
Yeah, again, this is why I debated. We only have about a quarter of our transfer pool in right now, and that is typical. Transfers come home, they're in finals right now. And they come home, mom and dad say, or they say, I'm not going back. Now they start to think about transferring. So the activity is just incredible between really May and the start.
So even the top three numbers there are probably an underrepresentation.
I hope not. So I hope they're not at this stage. Because, we'll probably end up around 4,300 applications by when all is said and done. We'll see that many added in the next couple of months. And then the admissions piece, which I mentioned, someone asked earlier about the test scores, et cetera. We're going to measure a transfer applicant based on their performance at the college level, provided that they have 24 credits or more. Those that are falling short, we'll use a blended approach of high school transfer. So now we've recruited them, we've admitted them, those that are qualified. Time to figure out how to fund them. This is the most important question, folks, if you can imagine. It's the last thing that any applicant finds out about. I have to wait to discover it's all based on the income of last year. They can't file until beginning, once the financial regs are developed. So they begin their application process in January. We'll package them in March. These are statistics. I know Diane was in earlier this year to present to you all. And she showed you some of these. I thought it important to keep emphasizing just a little bit about our students from a financial aid perspective. 82% apply for aid. Almost all of them are judged to have need. And the need that they're judged to have is right around $13,000. $13,000. 46% of our students who are applying for aid have come from family incomes of less than $50,000.
That's a four-year need?
No, that's a one-year
need.
And our in-state tuition from the board for fall 13 was just under $20,000, and our out-of-state was just under $30,000.
Is that net income? Is that adjustable gross income, or is it total income?
It's total income in this slide.
$50,000.
Yep.
We have a very high percentage of our students that are eligible for federal Pell Grants. We're one of the highest in the system, actually. Mm-hmm. Stony Brook, I think, was just a little higher. It's a very income-challenged population.
See, even more reinforced in the next slide. 25% of those AID applicants have a zero EFC. That means that by federal government standards, they are judged to not be able to afford a single dollar towards their education. I think this is mentioned of the Pell. When they applied and admitted through the process, we send out aid in March. Diane Corbett and your folks put together a package soon next time. So the funding sources that will show up in the package, you'll see grants and scholarships, both federal, state, institutional, and then the loans and work, self-help option will also be part of the package. Next. So if you take a look at undergraduate funding sources of current UAlbany undergraduates, 81% of their funding sources can be tracked to federal loans, work study, and federal grants. Another 14% state grants and scholarships. And then between the SUNY tuition credit, which is actually institutional money, and the institutional aid through merit scholarship and foundation, that makes about 10% of our funding sources. And this excludes athletics. We didn't fold in the athletic aid into this figure. To add some dollar values to that, you can see approximately $75 million in federal loans, another $23 million in Pell Grants, and SEOG state TAF program, which is critical for us, $17 million. And then between the last three sources, you've got close to $7.5 million. Not a lot of work study money available here at the university. Minimum wage going up, students are making the money, we actually lost some hours for students to work here.
And finally, before I turn it over to Kevin, let me talk about the retention efforts, because you know, you spend all of this time, money, energy recruiting a class, enrolling what you hope is a class that's going to be here and experience, have a positive experience, and you want to retain them. The first two slides kind of we do examine why students leave. Our Office of Withdrawal and Reentry, which is housed in our undergraduate education, which is part of SUPS team, does exit surveys of students who are formally withdrawing, and as well as we'll periodically survey students, probably not as much as I like or that we're going to do, but to try to determine what those reasons are. So financial, not what they expect, family, medical, you can see the list of, it's not a, and there are many, many more items. And of course, some of these items all are combined together. You could be financial, and therefore your experience wasn't what you expected, et cetera. There's various combinations. We also have the ability to take a look at students that enrolled at the University of Albany, and then the following year didn't return, to find out where they actually may have landed. This is at a high level, looking at percentages, 9% private institutions, 23% went to four-year public, 27% two-year public. We can drill down geographically. We can impose an EFC on each of these students and really get some good information to try to get an understanding of just where they're heading.
Before you proceed, on the previous slide, do we have a breakdown of, because these may be top reasons, but I'm kind of curious if, like, the first two things on there are account for, let's say, 80% of the data.
I didn't include that in here, but yes, we do. But it's, you can't, Dr. Williams will, you can't add some survey, you can't just add survey results together and come up with it. So it's, it, sometimes the way they answer the question, ask the question, it's difficult. So just kind of tabulating reasons is the best avenue. But yes, I do have. I mean, financial is the number one reason.
Is there a list in declining order of
this is pretty much it, this is pretty much based on the, what was came out of the withdrawal and reentry in an order of their rationale.
Okay.
So we, as I mentioned, we'll look at the next slide. So,
what's the overall, I'm sorry about this, what's the overall retention rate?
Yeah, first to second year. There's a slide in there, but what, I think it's 3-4 in there, so. But over the last 5 years, we've ranged from high of 85 and 80, that's right, 81.5, national public 70%. We've got the 6-year rate, 67, 64. But one of the things too that that's worth mentioning at this point is that over the last 2 years we've seen an improvement in our both 4-year and 6-year graduation rate. We promised SUNY that we would increase as part of the 2020 plan. We've indicated that we would improve our retention, our graduation rate 7%. Over the course of the 2020 for life. So if we look at 2012, we had 53% 4-year and 64% 6-year. In 13, we have 56% 4-year and 66% 6-year. So that's 6 and 3% respectively towards our goals.
I guess the question would be why?
Let's go back up to the, as we go, it's retention is campus-wide responsibility. Within academic affairs, if we had to, locate undergraduate education is really is carrying the major responsibility here for our retention initiatives, at least on the academic affairs side. They include through the advisement office and through student engagement, through honors college, through transfer experience, and other initiatives. Within my unit, we've done some business practice alterations in our registrar's office, as well as a one-stop shop that helped to create a customer service connection and create an atmosphere for students to improve their experience. And I can't say enough about the importance of institutional research planning and effectiveness, which is under academic affairs. It provides information for the entire institution, but it grabs the data for us that can help us with our decision making process. And of course, student success and schools and colleges. So we recently appeared to, some of the things that we've been doing recently, I can't take any credit for but through our living learning communities, advising plus and program and writing and critical inquiry, three areas that we have a significant impact, we believe, on our new freshmen as well as continuum students. The third program, the one in critical writing and critical inquiry, was just started this past fall, and so we're excited about the potential that is going to present. Well, let's take a look just quickly some of the.
Is that an optional program?
Or? No.
The writing program is not optional. In fact, what it does, all new students, including transfers, are required to pursue that course. It guarantees essentially that every one of our new students the opportunity to have a small class and a personal connection in their first year here at the university. So it's also going to be a way that we can communicate things to an entire group, i.e. freshmen, that we really have never had the ability to go into a freshman writing class and say something about, we're doing a financial literacy program, for instance. And, did you think about this? And so there are a lot of strong positives that are going to be associated with that, in addition to helping them become better writers. The living learning community, theme-based, here's a list of some of those opportunities. Students are gathered around similar interests or majors, and it's characterized by sharing courses together, 1 to 2 courses. They get to interact with faculty and upperclassmen. And Advising Plus, which is continuing to evolve, has your traditional and offers the full range of services like tutoring, peer mentoring, and study groups. But it also works on exposing students to engaged learning opportunities like study abroad, internships, student research, undergraduate research, and then community and public service programs. So it's housed in advisement services and provides the students with a chance to really expand their options here. And for those of you, if you want more, a little bit more information on our website, it's very clear to find. These are the student engagement opportunities that coming from the Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education. The SUC Living Learning, and I apologize for the size, I debated on whether you can see here some of the activities and some of the opportunities. There's a food for thought program where students can take their faculty member to lunch, and it's funded by comes out of a university fund. We have a PALS mentoring program where I can be assigned a new student and work with them to help them in their transition. So all in all, some real positives that feed to appear your question is why or how are these things improving.
And these were all new, but again, 3 years ago, and they were intended to get that rainbow.
You've seen this slide. Finally, next slide. The last thing on our guard, we're working with the institutional research on kind of develops a predictive modeling initiative where we collect data from enrollment management, undergraduate education, student success, and other sources to try to come up with an idea. Next slide, too. And these are some of the elements. Some of them we have, some of them we haven't collected. There are many more that might be out there that might serve a value, but the idea is to be able to assess students at various points in time here at the university to maybe be able to offer some early intervention that will help them and help us retain them. So. That's all I have.
Okay. Let me just do a pause. I'm mindful of the time and your time commitment. Undergrad, you've now taken the fire hose, the 60,000 foot fire hose of undergraduate enrollment management. We also have an opportunity to talk about graduate enrollment management. but we could also do it at another time. So let me defer to you to a decision on that. We've got about 5 minutes of your time.
Yeah, I think we need to defer.
We'll hold. Okay, defer.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Williams.
I know you were anxious as
Your test has been postponed.
Right.
I used to love that. We do have three recognition resolutions, and I am not going to read the body of each of these to you because they're somewhat redundant and you would throw something at me. But I would like to read each of the actual resolution pieces into the minutes. The first one is for Clara, resolved in a recognition of her service as the elected student member. The council expresses its gratitude for her active participation and leadership, and be it further resolved that the council extends its good wishes to her as she continues her studies at the University of Albany. I entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And we'll give that to her. The second is to Garrett. Resolved that in recognition of his service as the graduate student representative, the council expresses its gratitude for his active participation and leadership, and be it further resolved that the council extends its good wishes to him as he continues his studies at the University of Oregon. Motion.
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much, Gary. Really
thank you.
Thank you. And finally, Joette. Resolved that in recognition of her service as the faculty representative, the council expresses its gratitude for her active participation and leadership, and be it further resolved that the council extends its good wishes to her as she assumes her duties as the chair of the University Senate for the 2014-2015 academic year. A motion. And second it all in favor.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, would you entertain a similar motion for Michael Stein to pass a resolution to be presented?
Absolutely. And can we make that motion as a unanimous motion of the entire council?
Sure. Yes. Sure.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay. Rob's still there.
Hang in. That's Rob.
I've been here. You know what it is? It's not really, the acoustics aren't great, so I jump in when I can actually know what I'm saying or responding to properly. But I've been here.
It's an out of program.
There is no old business, but new business. You do have an agency
update? Just very, very quickly, I was going to mention something about the shared governance conference. There's a couple of things that are moving through that may or may not move through the legislature. One is the smoking ban on campuses, which I think councils will have an opportunity to weigh in some fashion in the event that it does pass. And there's activity by the association to become more engaged and more proactive on some budget cuts, et cetera, that affect SUNY, and we're developing that with the board of directors for ACT that will come back individual campuses for that. So that's the update. Thank you.
Is there any other new business to come before the council? Seeing none, can we have a motion to adjourn?
No.
One second. Thank you very much. Commencement ceremony is May 17th at 8:00.
Thank you.
The recording for a second.
Sure, for a second.